And Don is here.
Good evening, everyone. Good to see you all. Hello, Donna.
Hi, Donna.
Good. There's Susie. Good. All right. Let me just wait another minute or so. So it's so good to see you all again tonight. This is unfortunately our last class of these four sessions on uniting wisdom and compassion. So let's go ahead and get started. And if other folks are joining in, they can come in and participate when they arrive. So I'm going to share on the screen the prayers that we've been doing before the class, beginning with the praise to Shakyamuni Buddha that we'll do three times. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. We'll do the short mandala offering. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandalakam Niryata Yami. And then refuge in bodhicitta. Oops, I'm sorry, I hit the wrong button there. Refuge in bodhicitta before the teaching. We'll do this once in English and then twice in the Tibetan. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Sangye chodang soki choknam la jang chu bardu dakni kyabsu chi daki chanyen gi pe sanam gi dola penchir sangye drupar sho Sangye chodang soki choknam la jang chu bardu dakni kyabsu chi Daki chanyen gipe sanam gi dola penchir sangye drupar sho. Okay, now we can take it off of that screen. All right, let's do a meditation tonight on what we discussed at the very end of last week's class, the compassion that is the first of the three types, the compassion that we say is observing mere sentient beings, meaning sentient beings that aren't being qualified in the ways that the other two types of compassion that we're going to be examining tonight, not being qualified in those ways. So here we're simply looking at the situation that sentient beings are in, observing them through the lens of understanding their suffering by using this analogy that we went into briefly last week, the bucket and the well, that with various points of analogy that we can meditate on. So again, I did provide you with a written meditation of that you can use, and I'll be kind of going through that. Hopefully you've had a chance to do that, but I'll kind of guide you in that. But we'll begin with, as usual, just a few minutes of focused meditation. So just allow the mind to settle. No doubt we've had many things throughout our day that we might even still be a bit preoccupied with. As much as possible, try to let all of that go and just bring your awareness to the breath. Again, work with the breath in whatever way is suitable for your mind. And in a few minutes, I'll come in and we'll go through this meditation and then channel that into setting our motivation for tonight. So now let's engage in this meditation. And in terms of who we're going to be working with, I think it's best if we work with someone who's already very dear to us. The instructions tell us to start with ourselves. But let's work with that next person we would cultivate the compassion for, which is essentially the person who we find it quite easy to develop compassion in relationship to. So think about the person or being who you feel very, very dear to, perhaps the closest person that you have in this life, and it could even be a pet, a parent, a child, a partner, a friend, whoever it is that you want to work with in this meditation, visualize them in the space before you. So we're going to work with this analogy that Master Chandrakirti uses in his text, in this homage of the bucket and the well. So first we're going to start by visualizing everything involved in that analogy and then correlate it to the situation that this being in front of us is going through. So imagine a bucket that is traveling in a well, tied to a wheel, controlled by the operation of the mechanism. And the bucket goes down into the dark depths of the well, then comes back up to the brighter area at the top. It does this over and over again. Never really leaving the well, continually just going from top to bottom and everywhere in between. And when the bucket is drawn up, it takes great difficulty, great effort. But when it goes back down, because it is empty and because of gravity, it just falls quite naturally to the bottom. And also we can think about how this movement of the bucket up and down and everywhere in between is involved in a process of which the order is very hard to determine. And where do things happen? What happens first? What happens next? It all kind of blurs into one. And while this bucket is going up and down inside the well, it is clattering against the sides of the well, being battered and broken. So just hold that image. And now let's correlate it to the situation of the being in front of us, this very dear one in our lives. So first, just as the bucket is tied by a rope to the wheel, so we ourselves and that being in front of us is bound by past actions, karma, that is contaminated by the afflictive emotions, especially by the deeper root error, the ignorance, specifically that grasping at that sense of I that is in error, that is totally a mistaken idea, a misconception. But this being in front of you is bound by karma, delusions, and ignorance in this way. I think that this is their situation. And then in the same way that the bucket depended upon an operator, you know, in order for it to go from one place to another within the well, the person, this person in front of us, this dear one, has been wandering in psychic existence, in the well of psychic existence, dependent upon their own minds, their untamed minds, their minds that have not known any real peace. And then too, just as the bucket travels very easily down to the bottom of the well, Let's go to the third point of analogy. Just as the bucket travels within the well from the bottom all the way up to the top, so this being in front of you travels among the various stations of psychic existence, being born over and over again as the lower realm rebirths, the upper realm rebirths, always taking rebirth within the well of psychic existence. Everything from the top to the bottom. The brightness of the upper rebirths to the darkness of the lower rebirths. And then on to the fourth point of analogy. That just as the bucket descends easily in the well, but is difficult to draw upward, even with hard work, so difficult. So, due to the fact of this being's tendencies of their own mind, their own delusions, they are easily drawn down into the lower rebirths, while right now they might be in an upper existence. They have known those lower existences for the greater part of their time in samsara, because it's so easily under the control of those delusions to fall to those lower rebirths. And just as it's difficult to draw the bucket back up when it's full, it's also difficult for this being in front of us to experience the higher rebirths, to create the causes for that, due to the fact that their mind is under the control of delusion so much, requires a great deal of effort. And then just as we saw that it's unclear where one part of the mechanism begins, where the next one kicks in, where it ends, becomes a vicious circle, it's also very difficult to pick apart the three factors involved in psychic existence for this being. The afflictions that are seemingly the start of things, but they of course are also influenced by the other aspects, the actions, the karma that this being engages in. And then the resultant states. And in those resultant states, this being, through the force of their afflictions, creates more karma, and we have overlapping rounds of dependent arising, all these various factors. Very hard to pick it all apart and say, what's the starting point? Instead, they're just caught up in a seemingly unending process. It's very difficult to discern all the various components involved. Again, just keep turning your attention to this being through these ways, that this being is like that bucket in a well. And then finally, perhaps the one that makes us generate compassion to an even greater degree for this being is that throughout the duration of their time in the well, which has been since beginningless time, just like the bucket has been battered by crashing against the walls of the well, so too this being in front of us, this dear one, has had to experience the suffering of pain, the physical and mental pain, anguish, has had to experience the suffering of change that occurs when pleasure leads to pain, doesn't really satisfy, and moreover, the deepest level of suffering, pervasive conditioned suffering, that is comprised by the mere fact that this being is caught in an afflicted process of conditioning. Wherever they go in the well, just like the bucket in the well, wherever they go in the well of samsara, they experience the varieties of suffering. They've never known one moment of being free from that, just like the bucket has never been outside the well. So try to cultivate a vivid sense of the pain of this being that you're observing, this dear one. And because you already feel a deep closeness and affection for them, begin by contemplating the first of the three thoughts of compassion. How wonderful it would be if this being were free from suffering and all the causes of suffering, if they were extricated from the situation they are in completely. How wonderful, how nice, how amazing. And then elevate that compassion as if you were the ruler of a kingdom making a decree by thinking, may this being be free from suffering and all the causes of suffering. Without a doubt, may they know that freedom. May that come to pass for them. And really feel that compassionate thought that wants this to happen for them. Not just a nice idea, we want this to be their reality. And then to take this to the level of great compassion, which is the compassion that is essential for developing bodhicitta, we have to get involved ourselves in the situation of that being. here, observing them again through the understanding of how we've contemplated their situation earlier, think, I will free them from suffering and the causes of suffering. This being that I already am so close to, dear to, I will take responsibility for them. And now within the understanding that every being that exists has been just like this dear friend of yours, this dear being. They may not be that close to you in this life, but because you have been in samsara since beginningless lives, every being has been a dear friend, a mother, a father, a partner, a child, a pet, whatever. They've been in that role of being someone very close. Therefore, we can have the great compassion that takes responsibility for all of them because they are equal in regard to the predicament that they are in. Just like the bucket and the well, every one of these beings is caught up in samsara through the myriad factors that we discussed, that we meditated on. Therefore, I will free all of these beings from suffering and all the causes of suffering. And how will I do this? Right now, I'm completely incapable of even helping this one dear friend in front of me. How will I help them and all beings? Only by becoming more capable. Only by becoming a Buddha. And in attaining that state, I then will have the complete compassion that embraces all of those beings with that wish to free them from suffering, together with the wisdom that knows how to do that, and the power, the means by which I can affect their welfare. Therefore, I must become a Buddha in order to benefit this being and all sentient beings. And therefore, I'm going to engage in this class tonight within that motivation of bodhicitta that aspires for our own Buddhahood, so we then can help others to be free from their suffering and realize their full potential in complete enlightenment. Okay, good. So I hope that was useful just to do, because I wanted to do a review of what we talked about at the end of last week anyway. So this was a way of doing a short review in meditation. Obviously, if you wanted to do this on your own, I would hope you'd spend a little more time on each of these points. And as was mentioned in the instruction to the meditation, start with yourself so we understand our own predicament, then apply that, as we did in the meditation tonight, to that one being who we perhaps is like the dearest person in our lives right now, or someone who's already in that camp of being a friend, a dear one. And then we can extend it to everyone in that category, and then we can extend it to the strangers who we don't have that much of an intimate relationship with, and then we can extend it out even eventually to include the difficult people in this world, those in our lives who have caused us or those that we care about pain and suffering, or those whose views are totally opposed to our own, or whatever the case might be. So this is what we went through at the end of last week, the first type of the three types of compassion. Tonight we're going to finish this one off with a little bit more commentary from Lama Tsongkhapa, and then we're going to go on to go through the other two types of compassion. So just so you know, again, I won't go through all of this, but handout number 3 of 4 kind of goes into the various points of the analogy. It's a nice little summary that you can work with. And again, it shows the various realms of existence on that same sheet that all the beings are born in, from the bottom of the well to the top of the well. And it also has the 12 links of dependent arising that were mentioned in that 5th point of analogy, where we see that, again, those that are afflictions, which are link number 1, 8, and 9, these things things that are afflicted states of mind that drive the whole process. And of course, the first link, ignorance, is the real root of all of our problems, but it's not always so obvious because there are overlapping sets of these 12 links constantly. Then we have karma, the second of the three factors besides afflictions. That's links number 2 and 10. The initial karmic seed that we create through the force of an action, and then it ripening into link number 10, which propels us into our next existence. Therefore, it's given that name. And then the remaining ones, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then 11 and 12, all of those are resultant states that are part of samsara, the things that we have to experience as part of our being in samsara. So essentially, these are all the factors that are involved in teachings on the 12 links of dependent origination, which are an important way of understanding how we are involved in our suffering and also how others are caught up in theirs. So let's go to the text. I think we're on page 12 of the text. At the top of the screen there, we have where we are continuing from. We had just gone through the six features of analogy. It says here, the application of similarity by way of those six features is not made merely for the sake of understanding the way that sentient beings wander in psychic existence. We have to have that understanding. You know, we have to be able to see how it is that sentient beings are suffering. Again, we look at it for ourselves, but then we can also transfer that same understanding to others. But he's saying it's not merely made for the purpose of, you know, understanding their situation. The question arises then, well, then what is the purpose? The answer is, previously, Chandrakirti indicated that one who wishes to enter the Mahayana must initially generate great compassion. But he did not show how to generate compassion in meditation. Here, by showing the way that sentient beings wander powerlessly in psychic existence, he indicates how to generate great compassion through meditation. So this is how we are actually able to cultivate great meditation. I mean, meditation on great compassion is through the understanding that we're looking at here. By the way, I forgot to include in our thing, the recitation of verses. We won't maybe don't have to go through that tonight. Maybe we'll even do that later. But what we're going through in terms of this verse is verse number 3 there, homage to that compassion for migrators who are powerless like this bucket traveling in a well. Through initially adhering to a self and I, that's the root of our problems, this view of the transitory collection that is a root form of ignorance, and then generating attachment for things, thinking this is mine. So again, that's what we're looking at in terms of our this particular commentary that we're going through with Lama Tsongkhapa. So again, he's saying this is the way that we actually generate great compassion. And so this paragraph and the paragraphs that are following just kind of recap kind of the main points of those six features of analogy. The first one, this isn't the first of the six. This is the first one mentioned here, but it's actually the second point of analogy. By what agency do sentient beings enter into psychic existence? You know, who's the operator of the mechanism? By just this extremely unpeaceful, untamed mind. Then they jump back to the first point of analogy, Tsongkhapa. He says, where and how do they wander? No, I'm sorry, this is the third point of the analogy. From the peak of psychic existence to the most torturous hell, from the very top of the well to the very deep, dank part of the bottom, without the slightest interruption in their circling. Now we jump back to the first one, about the rope that is binding the bucket. By what causes and conditions do they wander? How? By the power of contaminated actions and afflictions, karma and delusions. These are the two root causes of our suffering, of our being in samsara. Then on to the idea again of, this is actually still part of that. These actions and afflictions cause us to wander in bad migrations by the power of our non-meritorious actions, our non-virtuous actions and afflictions, and in happy migrations by the power of meritorious and unmoving actions and afflictions. So if we go back to this little chart that shows the different realms of existence, it is through our non-meritorious actions that we fall into the lower realms, the lower rebirths, those last three animals, hungry ghosts, hell realms. These are essentially obviously the realms that are induced by non-meritorious actions. In terms of those that are due to meritorious actions, that would include the human realm, the anti-god or demigod realm, and the god realm. These three are all due to meritorious actions. The other realms that are above them, they are higher rebirths, but they are actually due to what we call unmoving karma, which is a form of meritorious or virtuous karma. But it's one that is induced through the force of our meditative stabilization. So if we develop any of the four concentrations, then we have the seed planted to cause us to take rebirth in their respective form realms. And if we develop any of the four formless absorptions, which are at the top there, then we generate the karma to be reborn in their respective formless realms. So they're called unmoving karma because they don't cause you to take rebirth anywhere else. They only cause you to take rebirth within that respective realm that you generated that type of concentration or absorption in relation to. So again, most of you have studied that in your teachings on karma, but that is what is being referred to in that part of the commentary when he says here about the middle of the screen, they take happy rebirth migrations by the power of meritorious and unmoving actions and afflictions. So then it says to be, this is the other factor, I think the fourth factor? Yeah, the fourth factor. To be born in bad migrations, the process operates automatically. You know, there's no effort involved in falling to a bad migration. But it is difficult to be born in happy migrations because great effort must be made to achieve their causes. Again, just like the bucket falling to the bottom of the well very easily, rising back up to the top with much more difficulty. So then it goes on to this I mentioned last week. There's this little citation from the sutras that talks about the difficulty of attaining a good rebirth, that the preponderance of the time sentient beings are spending in samsara is in the lower rebirths, in the bottom of the well. So it says the topics of discipline says that instances of leaving either a happy or a bad migration and going to a bad one are as numerous as the particles of this great earth. And that instances of leaving either a happy or a bad migration and going to a happy one are as few as the particles held on the tip of a fingernail. So they say actually the Buddha, you know, was giving, when he was propounding the sutra, he actually was there on the banks of the river Ganges or whatever, all these grains of sand or whatever, and he took his fingernail and he just held up the few little grains of sand that can be on a fingernail to demonstrate that of all the rebirths that take place from either a happy or a bad migration that end up in a happy one, that's the small quantity within all the particles in this earth. You know, pretty overwhelming analogy when we think about it. We might look at it and think, well, it seems like there's an awful lot of beings in this happy rebirth we call a human rebirth on this planet. But nonetheless, you know, again, it's still minuscule compared to the vast number of beings that exist. As I pointed out last week, a larger quantity of beings is in the lower realms at any moment in time, simply because it's so easy to generate the karma that causes you to go down into one of those unfortunate states. This is the fifth point of analogy. Whenever any of the three groups of thorough afflictions in a round of dependent arising is present, the two remaining groups are also operating in other rounds of dependent arising. Therefore, the process is uninterrupted, and every day, like ripples in water, beings are tormented more than once by the three sufferings. That's the sixth point of analogy. So again, the fifth one had to do with the afflictions, the actions, and then the resultant states, how in, within the 12 links of dependent arising, we have them overlapping each other constantly. So we have, you know, they're operating within other rounds of dependent arising. And then the sixth one has to do with, again, understanding the full nature of their suffering, as we meditated on when we did that tonight before class. So the situation of sentient beings is pretty severe. So it says, if your mind has not been affected by thinking about the way that you yourself wander in psychic existence, then when you think about these modes of suffering in other sentient beings, there's no way that you as a beginner can find their suffering unbearable, because that's the place we have to get to. But we have to, again, start with ourselves and then translate that to others. So therefore, he says, as Chandrakirti says in his commentary on Aryadeva's 400 stanzas, first you should think about these in yourself, and afterwards meditate on them and other sentient beings. And again, I gave you the guidance on that in the meditation as well as we talked about it earlier. So then a question, jump to the other page. The question arises, can great compassion be induced merely by meditating on the way that other sentient beings are tortured in psychic existence by suffering and by the sources of suffering, or is another aid needed? This gets to the other factor that is very much involved, that's why, you know, tonight I chose somebody who's already very dear to you. We have to feel some empathy and closeness, some affection for that being. If we don't have that, then we won't really care so much about their situation. And this is why, again, the techniques that are set out to develop bodhicitta always incorporate some way of trying to embrace the needs of others, the welfare of others, so that we begin to have that empathic response to their suffering. If we don't have that sense of kinship, of closeness, it's going to be very hard to generate great compassion for them, even if we understand the extent to which they're suffering. And so Tsongkhapa is going to explain why this is so and how we oftentimes even might have the opposite response of wishing someone harm when we see their suffering. So Tsongkhapa answers, in the world, when suffering is seen in an enemy, not only is it not unbearable, but one delights in it. You know, when we hear about the political person that we, you know, maybe despise having some difficult time or dealing with some problems, we might really take delight in our heart and thinking, oh, good, you know, they were such a miserable person, I want them to suffer. That's not, you know, finding their suffering unbearable, that's taking delight in it. Then, a stranger, when a person who has neither helped nor harmed one is seen to suffer, Tsongkhapa says, one will in most cases pay no attention to that person. You know, we have an indifference towards those beings because they're not in our circle of concern. So these reactions are due to not having a sense of pleasantness with respect to these persons. Again, that's such a key element in terms of developing this great compassion. So he goes on to say, then though we know when a friend suffers and we see that, it is unbearable in the sense that one must do something about it. You know, right? If we have somebody dear to us who calls us and they're in a tight situation, a difficult situation, we reach out to them almost immediately. You know, the degree of unbearability, Tsongkhapa says, is just as great as one's sense of pleasantness toward that person. Therefore, it is an important essential that one must generate a sense of strong cherishing and affection for sentient beings. So, among the kings of scholars, he says, there are two systems concerning the means for generating a sense of pleasantness. These are involved in the two techniques for generating bodhicitta, right? That we generate those sense of kind of holding others dear and being close to them first, and then we generate love and compassion on the basis of those, and then that gets channeled into our bodhicitta. But he says of the first, which is referring to the sevenfold cause and effect technique, Chandrakirti says in his commentary to Aryadeva's 400, that if sentient beings are considered to have been friends, such as parents, from beginningless time, then one can bear to plunge into psychic existence for their sake. You know, that we really feel that movement towards wanting to relieve their suffering, because we know that they have, although they aren't in that role in this life, they have been that role in another life. The great being Chandragoman and the king of scholars Kamalashila also presented it this way. So there are others who also presented that technique, again, what's called the sevenfold cause and effect, which, by the way, I'll put this in the chat box during the break. In case you want a single sheet, I think I've distributed this in at least one of the other classes that I taught for Kadampa Center. But this is like all of the techniques to generate bodhicitta on one page, because we have the seven-point or sevenfold cause and effect instruction, which I won't go into tonight, but again, that's the summary of those points. Then right now we're going to go on to talk briefly about the instruction on equalizing and exchanging self with others, which is the other main one. And then there is a way of combining them into what we call the 11-step combined method. These 11 steps help you to bring the best of both of those together into a very powerful meditation. So anyway, I'll put that in the chat box during the break. But what we are talking about here then in that last sentence of that paragraph about the middle of the screen, it says the second is the system of the glorious Shantideva. These can be known from my explanations elsewhere in the great exposition of the stages of the path. So the second one, again, is where we work on replacing the tendency we have to be self-centered, self-preoccupied, what we often call self-cherishing, where we hold our needs to be more important than those of others, and we even neglect the needs of others. So in that technique, what you're doing is you're trying to see the disadvantages of continuing to be so self-centered, because it's been a part of the problem for us, as well as the ignorance that's grasping at this self, that view of the transitory collection that we discussed last week. This self-cherishing tends to elevate our own needs to the greater level, and we neglect those of others. We might even harm them in the process of getting what we want. Well, in that technique, you work on diminishing that by first equalizing self and others. Get yourself and others to the same level first, and then begin to hold others as more important. Cherish them. And this is actually how His Holiness says that we are wisely selfish. By being dedicated to the welfare of others, we actually accomplish our own welfare. Your achievement of Buddhahood is contingent upon you cherishing all beings to that degree. So these are the two things that are embedded within those instructions that help us to develop a sense of fondness, connection to others, a desire to actually benefit them. So it's not enough just to understand their suffering. We have to be concerned about it. We have to have an opening of our heart towards them. So then he goes on to say, those who strive to train in great compassion through strongly cherishing sentient beings and reflecting on the ways in which those beings are tortured in psychic existence make meaningful Chandrakirti's uncommon expression of worship. Those who otherwise claim to be skilled in this, you know, but don't do that, are like prattling parrots. Again, another sort of put down for those who, you know, kind of read these teachings and might profess to them, but they don't actually engage in the techniques of generating that. Yeah, this is what this whole course is about, is to help us to have the fuel that we can bring into our meditation and generate this great compassion together with the wisdom initially here that understands their situation very well, and moreover, as was just pointed out, that feels close to them, that cherishes them, that is concerned about them. So he says, later I will explain how this comes to be called simply compassion observing sentient beings. So we won't talk about that right now. Now we go into the next, the last two lines of the homage, and this is the conclusion to the verses that we've been studying over these four sessions. So this contains in these two lines the reference to both of the remaining two types of compassion, what we call compassion observing phenomena and compassion observing the unapprehendable or the unobservable. We'll explain those later as well. So Tsongkhapa says, in order to illuminate the compassion's observing phenomena and the unapprehendable from the viewpoints of the objects observed, Chandrakirti says, homage to that compassion for migrators seen as evanescent and empty of inherent existence, like a moon and rippling water. So this is the analogy that's used, is like a dark night when the reflection of a full moon in the sky is happening on the surface of a lake. And there's going to be two ways we're going to talk about that. So just keep that in mind as we get into this. And they're spelled out in the meditation I prepared for you from Jeffrey Hopkins' book as well. So Tsongkhapa then says, Chandrakirti's, oh, actually, let me take it off screen and share my slides for this. These are the two lines from this that, get that up here. There we go. Okay. This is, I didn't prepare many slides for this, but at least a few things, and because I wanted to put an image with this. So we have the second one. This is compassion observing phenomena. So Chandrakirti's homage to that is, homage to compassion, viewing migrators as evanescent or momentarily disintegrating, like the reflection of a moon in water that is stirred by a breeze. So pay no attention to the moon up in the sky. What you're paying attention to is the reflection of the moon in the water. And as this wonderful, you know, picture, whatever that I was able to find, shows, you've got the reflection flickering. It's never staying the same because you have a wind that's coming across the surface of the water that's rippling the top of the water. And therefore, the water, the reflection that is in the water is moving. It's not staying the same for even a second. This is mostly a teaching about that impermanence of beings, the subtle impermanence that is their constant change, as well as the gross impermanence that is their going out of existence, the death that happens to every one of us. Then the third is introduced in Lama Tsongkhapa's text as well. His homage to compassion observing the unapprehendable is homage to compassion viewing migrators as empty of inherent existence, though they appear to exist inherently, like the reflection of the moon in calm water. So here, once more, don't pay attention to the moon up in the sky. Say you were walking in the woods or something, which is actually how Jeffrey Hopkins sets out this analogy, and you weren't aware that there was a full moon up in the sky because the woods were pretty dense, but you happened to see a view of a lake in front of you that you didn't know was there, and you see the reflection of the moon in the surface of the lake. You might think for a moment that it's the real moon, right? Because the reflection is so on a still night when it seems to be there just unmoving and constant, you might mistake that reflection for being the real moon. But a reflection doesn't exist as a real moon. A reflection is just that. It's only a reflection. As I think His Holiness the Dalai Lama pointed out in one text, you can't send, a whole NASA team up to, to that moon that's in the lake. You're not going to have any success there. You have to send it to the actual moon up in the sky, which, by the way, I might mention, some of you have been perhaps purchasing this whole series that has been coming out of His Holiness with Venerable Thupten Chodron. The three types of compassion are actually in here in a wonderful section that I would really encourage you to read. It's from about pages, let's see, I marked it down on my sheet here, 182 to 205. It's the fourth volume in that series, I think. Fifth volume. And it's called In Praise of Great Compassion. So I may read a little bit from that later, but essentially just know that this is the analogy that's being used here. So you don't send a rocket team to the moon, reflection of the moon, because it can't serve as the real moon. The idea is that it's only a reflection, and therefore it has a falsity to it. Of course, the Buddha used a lot of these sorts of things to talk about emptiness. So when we get to that third compassion and discuss it in more detail, we'll talk about that as well as talking about emptiness itself and how we come to realize that. So let's go ahead and go back into the commentary now. We're on page 14 of the commentary. And Tsongkhapa says, let me get that back on screen. I'm pulling out my own hard copy here as well to refer to. So again, there's what he said in terms of the two comments on the homage that I had on the slides. In commenting on this, Chandrakirti says, homage to that compassion, but he omits for migrators. But his thought is that the migrators of the previous stanza are included as the objects observed by the latter two compassions. This is the important thing to understand, is that in no way are these two compassions observing anything different. They're observing migrating beings, because that's always the object of our compassion. We're just qualifying the sentient beings in a slightly different way. So this is how he explains both of these analogies together. An image of the moon appears in a portion of very clear water that is covered by ripples from a mild breeze. The water that serves as the basic object is actually apprehended prior to the reflection, but the reflection is manifestly apprehended as a real moon that disappears each day. Because we have sunrise and there's no more appearance of the moon and so on, or the moon is on the other side of the planet, whatever, and then it reappears later in the dark of night. The excellent ones, namely beings who are skilled in these ways, see momentary impermanence. That's the second of the two types of compassion, the optic way that we're qualifying beings, their momentary impermanence, and the emptiness of the nature of the moon as it appears to be. Just like we can see the emptiness of those beings in the way that they appear to be as so solid and concrete and independent when they don't have that at all. So going on, he says, as in the example, bodhisattvas who have come under the influence of compassion also see sentient beings who are in an ocean, the ocean being the view of the transitory, which is filled by a vast blue river of ignorance, the ignorance being the ignorance that is grasping at phenomena to inherently exist, that, again, this grasping at ourselves is a subset of that larger ignorance. They see that this ocean in which sentient beings abide is stirred by the winds of improper thought, and that the reflections of the being's own wholesome and unwholesome actions, which are like the moon in the sky, are reflected in front of them. You know, just a reflection of those that beings are experiencing. Nothing there in deeper reality. So, bodhisattvas see sentient beings with the suffering of composition, momentary disintegration descending on them, and they see beings as empty of inherent existence. Again, these are the two ways we're qualifying them, as being impermanent, having that momentary disintegration change, and empty of inherent existence. The deeper teachings, wisdom teachings on emptiness. So observing those sentient beings, you know, qualified in that way, let me move it up just a little here, bodhisattvas generate great compassion. And as explained earlier, their great compassion arises from reflecting on the pleasantness of sentient beings and on the ways in which they wander in psychic existence. So again, when we talk about this, it's not as important to understand, in my mind, all the various aspects of that part where you talk about the ocean that the moon is reflected in and the river of ignorance feeding into it and whatever, all of these various facets. But I'm going to share a little bit from this book in a moment on that. What's important in this analysis of these two other types of compassion is that we are really getting at some of the deeper errors that are involved that cause sentient beings to suffer. You know, this clinging to a sense of a self that is sort of permanent and unchanging, that is a part of the ignorance that we also are dealing with from lifetime to lifetime. And within a single life, not being acknowledging of the grosser level of impermanence that is entailed in having an existence. You know, so many beings have their head in the sands when it comes to even their own mortality. And even though they might acknowledge that sure they're going to die, they don't embrace it with any sort of ability to accept that fact. Instead, beings rail against that and experience so many difficulties and suffering because they cling to something the opposite of how things actually are. Remember what I talked about last week, that little quote from Noam Chomsky that essentially says, not only do beings not know what's happening to them, they don't even know that they don't know. You know, so again, with regard to impermanence, maybe there's a little bit that they might realize about some of that, but with regard to the deeper error that is involved in that third level of compassion, they don't understand to any degree their lack of inherent existence. They don't even question the nature of the self. They don't go to that place of investigating, do I exist in the way I appear or not? You have to be indoctrinated into these teachings to really begin that quest. So essentially, beings are making a lot of errors that are involved in their suffering as well. So when we are taking these wisdom teachings on impermanence and on emptiness and bringing them in these last two, it's for creating that force of being able to understand some of the deeper misconceptions that beings have that get them into trouble, that cause them to do, I think one teaching and from His Holiness, he was pointing out how because beings think that they're sort of not embracing their own impermanence, they think that this life is it, and they engage in everything with no regard for the karma that they're creating, for the problems that they're causing themselves in the future, and then they have to unfortunately go on to another existence because this life is going to come to an end and they will be propelled into their next existence. But it's because they're not accepting their own impermanence. It's because they are blind to that reality. And of course, the reality of their emptiness of inherent existence, all beings are blind to, unless once more you start opening that wisdom eye that investigates the nature of the self, investigates the nature of all phenomena. So the one little bit of commentary from His Holiness and Venerable Thipten Chodron in this book is on page 193 pertaining to that section that I just read. So it says, recall the analogy, the water corresponds to the ocean of the view of a personal identity or the transitory collection as we were calling it, that grasps I and mine as truly existent. This ocean is fed by the powerful river of ignorance grasping the five aggregates, the mind and body, that are the basis for the person and representative of all other phenomena, grasping all of that to exist truly. That's because it is said that we grasp at the aggregates first as it inherently exists, and then we impute an I on the basis of this, but we think that exists inherently too. You know, so there is both modes of ignorance involved, but the deeper error that we're making is thinking that this I is real. We're going to talk in a little bit about how it lacks any reality in terms of our ignorance, what it is imputing on that eye. But essentially, we have to, acknowledge that there's both of these involved in our error. We grasp at this body and mind as being real, and then we impute an eye on the basis of that, and we think that is real. And it's due to thinking that I is real that we get into trouble, because we think of things as mine. We possess things, and then we get angry at people who don't let us have those things, and we keep creating the attachment that grasps at more things and what have you. And by things, I mean all the varieties of stuff that are within samsara. Okay, so then His Holiness goes on. He says, while sentient beings struggle to stay afloat in this ocean of the view of the transitory collection, the powerful winds of distorted conceptions agitate the water where sentient beings appear as reflections of their virtuous and non-virtuous karma. This is really an interesting way of putting it. You know, we're all just reflections of our own virtuous and non-virtuous karma. It's just karma ripening into this product of our own minds going through experiences on the basis of our embodied state, and it's all just the propulsion of our karma that's causing us to have this sort of an experience, like a reflection that is just rippling and changing, constantly going through various iterations. Then the other point of it, they lack true existence, yet unaware of this fact, they continue to grasp themselves and all other phenomena as truly existent, as inherently existent. This is the biggest error that we're making, the deepest error that others and ourselves are making, is that we think everything is real in the way that our mind is grasping at it, which of course is also a product of how it is appearing to us. And we have this, through the force of our ignorance, this deeper imprint in our minds that causes everything to appear real, to appear to have its own reality, to be established on its own, independent of our minds. And of course, it doesn't exist that way at all. But we grasp at that appearance, and we think that that is true, and we just keep, again, generating the causes for more and more of the same. So then His Holiness continues. He says, yet they continue to grasp themselves and all other phenomena as truly existent and generate afflictions that bind them in samsara. Seeing sentient beings as qualified as being empty of true existence and knowing that they suffer due to grasping themselves and everyone and everything around them as truly existent entities, bodhisattvas generate strong compassion, wanting sentient beings to be free from ignorance, afflictions, and polluted karma, and all the dukkha, the suffering that these cause. So the idea here again is that when the bodhisattva, and of course us as bodhisattva wannabes, you know, when we bring these teachings to mind and we understand that sentient beings are under this delusion that they are permanent, unchanging, when they are actually impermanent, that they are substantially existent and real, when in reality they lack that, they are empty of inherent existence or independent existence, it should break our hearts. Because this is so unnecessary for them to suffer. If only they could change their minds and have that wisdom themselves, they would be free of all of that. They wouldn't experience any of these problems or difficulties. And that's why this compassion becomes so powerful, is because it unites it not just with the compassion that wants to free everybody from their suffering, but really deeply understands why they're suffering and what would be necessary for them not to suffer. Certainly to remove their misconceptions around permanence and this unchanging self that they're adhering to. That would be beneficial. What they have to get that at, of course, though, is the root problem, that they think that they exist truly, inherently, substantially. Again, that they set themselves up, that there's something there that is in reality the referent of that true sense of I that we hold to, for example, or true sense of self in regard to anything that we are adhering to in that way. So this is the biggest problem, of course, that sentient beings are dealing with. And the bodhisattva, or any of us who are meditating on this, our compassion should become even greater on the basis of that. So we'll look at that as we continue going through the text. Let me just do a little bit more, and then we'll take our mid-class break. So, I think I did that whole paragraph. Let's go ahead down to, we're in the middle of page, let's see, what is this, page 14. So it says there, even though the view of the transitory is ignorance, Chandrakirti explains ignorance separately as a river flowing into the ocean of the view of the transitory collection. Why? Because he is referring to the ignorance that induces the view of the transitory. Again, the conception of a self of phenomena. So as I said earlier, you know, if we think about it, whenever we see another being, right, we see their aggregates first, generally the form aggregate, right? We don't see their mental aggregate, you know, or their mental aggregates, their consciousness and what have you. But the consciousness is together with that form, unless the consciousness is left and they're a corpse. But essentially, we usually see their form. And then on the basis of adhering to that form that is appearing to us, their body as inherently existent, we label that as the person that we are referring to, and we think that they are real. So there's always like an appearance of something else that is the basis for the I, then, that we grasp at in a similar way. So we have this self, this grasping at a self of phenomena that refers to everything else, and then the I, or the person, as a more specific thing that we grasp at on the basis of something else having already been grasped at, which again is generally the physical form of that being who has appeared to us. So they say that's the order in which these forms of ignorance are developed. We first grasp at the aggregates as real, and then we grasp at the person who is imputed on those aggregates as real. Now, in terms of how we remove these, just to maybe throw in a little footnote here, it's actually said we do the opposite. We should initially begin by undermining the strong sense of an I that we are grasping at. But then if we've done that effectively, we should be able to just turn our mind towards the body, the aggregates, or whatever other phenomenon that we're talking about. And we have the template for how we can also remove that ignorance. Because it's the same misconception. It's just that it's more operative in regard to the I. That's why, once more, as we said last week, the view of the transitory collection is the root of psychic existence. Because once we cling to this I and the sense of the I as the possessor, that sense of my or mine, and we hold that to be real, that's when we get into trouble. That's when we start trying to defend that I and get what that I wants and push away what that I doesn't want. And that's, of course, how we generate various afflictions, how we generate karma, how we keep the whole thing going. But that's only a subset of the bigger ocean, or river in this case, that's flowing in of all of the ignorance that is grasping at everything else to inherently exist. So again, in terms of the order of generation, first we grasp the aggregates, then we grasp at the I. But in terms of removing it, first we meditate on the I and remove the ignorance around that, and then easy to generate the wisdom that knows that also the aggregates and other phenomena don't inherently exist. So anyway, just a little footnote on that. Let's go ahead and take a little break here, I guess. We're at 6 o'clock. Whoops, I meant didn't mean to hit that button. we're at 6 o'clock here in Santa Fe, so 6:01. So let's do, if it's okay, let's do 10 after. It gives you about 8-9 minutes. Hopefully it's long enough for a break tonight. I do have a fair amount of material I want to cover, so I don't want to spend too much time in break. So take your break now, and again, I'll ring the bell to reconvene everyone. All right, I'll see you shortly. Okay, so again, there will be an opportunity for some questions at the end. So if you do have any questions that come up that you want to not forget, you can put them in the chat box. By the way, I have put in the chat box the techniques for generating bodhicitta, that single page with all of that listed. So if you'd like to download that, you can help yourself to that. Let's go ahead and get back to our text and continue discussing these two types of compassion. So before we get into them individually, Tsongkhapa says, at this point in his commentary, Chandrakirti says that the three compassions are distinguished by the objects that they observe, not by their subjective aspects. In other words, it's the same compassionate thought towards beings. It's just the qualifications of the objects that they are observing, meaning the sentient beings. So then he says, therefore, all three types of compassion have as their subjective aspect the wish to free sentient beings from suffering. They are thereby similar in that they observe sentient beings. You know, again, it's just how we're qualifying those sentient beings. In discussing the first type of compassion, Chandrakirti says compassion for migrators. That was in the first line of verse 3. And in discussing the latter two types of compassion, he says evanescent migrators. In this way, he shows that sentient beings are the objects observed? So there's no qualms about that. I'm just going to read the first part of this paragraph because then it gets into another little bit that I'm just going to talk about very briefly. Still, compassion observing phenomena, that's the second one involved with impermanence and sentient beings qualified by that, does not observe just sentient beings, but those who momentarily disintegrate, who are impermanent. Therefore, the objects of observation are sentient beings qualified by momentary impermanence. So what he goes on to talk about, again, that I'm going to skip over a bit because it starts getting way into a whole little side topic here, is that when you begin to realize the impermanence of sentient beings and the impermanence of yourself, any misconceptions that you have around yourself being permanent, and one of those was actually a conception that existed at the time of the Buddha, and is still, I believe, certainly, as I understand it, part of the Vedic traditions of this clinging to what they call the Atman being some sort of permanent, unchanging soul or some entity that it's held by those traditions that is the essence of who the person is. Well, if the person is actually impermanent, momentarily disintegrating and changing, cannot be permanent and unchanging, it immediately starts to refute some of those other misconceptions that are involved around misconceptions of the person or of the self of persons that we have. So again, there's another one that I won't go into that's an even subtler form of a self of persons. But obviously the one that we're trying to negate eventually, which is when we get to the third type of compassion, is the inherently existent self, that all sentient beings are believing that they exist in that way, and they don't exist that way at all. So again, that's the deepest error that sentient beings are making. But this little paragraph that, again, I'm not going to go into in any great detail is essentially, and the next one as well, is essentially talking about how when you begin to realize the impermanence of yourself and other beings, that is always the doorway to understanding that they lack these coarser ways that we might misconceive the person. The subtlest way, again, though, is what we're really out to eventually negate, and we'll get on to that in a moment. So, again, I'm skipping over the rest of that one paragraph and also the top paragraph on page 15. Now we're going to talk about the third one in more detail. Again, because we just had that one little paragraph about compassion observing phenomena is observing sentient beings qualified by their impermanence, their momentary disintegration. But again, that also implies the grosser way that they experience impermanence. Now, on to the third one, compassion observing the unapprehendable also does not observe mere sentient beings. It observes a special object, sentient beings who are empty of inherent existence. This is this way of bringing that wisdom, the final wisdom that we're trying to generate, into our compassion. Unapprehendable means not truly existent. It refers to the referent object, in this case, those sentient beings that we're observing, not existing in the way that they are conceived to exist by a consciousness grasping at signs of inherent existence, again, because there is that false appearance of inherent existence. So giving the name, observing the unapprehendable or unapprehendable compassion to the observation of sentient beings qualified by non-true existence is a contraction. And again, they're also the previous one, observing phenomena, is also a contraction because it's observing sentient beings who are designated to phenomena, to the aggregates, and therefore we're observing them in terms of the transitory nature of that being and those aggregates, and therefore they are phenomena that momentarily disintegrate. So let's take it off screen here for a moment and talk a bit more about this compassion observing the unapprehendable. So again, just to be clear, we call it unapprehendable because you cannot apprehend true existence. This is the whole point of our meditation on emptiness, is that we think that things exist inherently, and we think they exist from their own side, and we grasp at that, and that's even how they appear to us. Everything has that false appearance. But you cannot really get to a valid apprehension of those things, a valid cognition of that inherent existence. In that way, it's unapprehendable. It's unobservable. For the yogi or yogini who is focused on analyzing to try to find that inherent existence that seems so real, it cannot be found. therefore, when we're observing sentient beings, we're talking about them being qualified as lacking that inherent existence. No longer having that, what we think is apprehendable that is actually unapprehendable. Okay. So this is the idea behind it. So let's talk a bit about this process. Again, when things appear to us, if we talk about the whole process, and Lama Zopa Rinpoche goes into this in some detail in his book, How Things Exist, I think is where that's located. One of the free books from the Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archives. You can find it at lamayeshe.com if you're interested. Again, it's called How Things Exist. He goes into this three-step process by which we are clinging to things as inherently existent. First, the base appears to us and we learn the label for it. So let's use something that, you know, came about in our lifetime, right? The iPad, you know. I remember how people were like going nuts for the iPad here in New Mexico, down in Albuquerque. There's an Apple store. There were all these people lined up then, you know, to purchase one. They were even interviewing them, and one person, they said, you're interested in getting the iPad? And he says, yeah, definitely. And the interviewer asked him, do you know what it is? And he said, no, but I want one. So, you know, this is what happens. We, you know, have these new things that get introduced in our culture, and we don't even necessarily know what's all involved in them, but we learn a label for them, and we know what it's kind of imputed to, but we already start to think about all these qualities of it and build it all up into something that's way beyond what's actually there. So first, a basis appears, and say you are that new person, you're back in the year, whenever that happened, when the iPad was introduced, and you go into the Apple store. And there in front of you is this shiny screen, you know, with metallic-y looking thing and whatever. And you've got the basis for it, and you've learned the label. It's an iPad. At that very next moment, the second step is that iPad, the label, seems to kind of melt into the basis and project back at us as if it's a real iPad. This is the deeper imprint that we have in our minds that causes everything to appear real from its own side, established from its own side, having its own identity, not contingent upon us labeling it as that. Again, the iPad is just a label we give to something that has those particular properties. And of course, now there are more things beyond the iPad that are tablets and what have you that are very similar to what it was. But essentially, this basis no longer seems to be merely labeled. It is now inherently that object. It's coming, you know, projecting back at us as if it's real from its own side. The very next instant, Rinpoche says. Then, of course, in the next instant, we grasp at that as real. We believe in that appearance. Why would we question it? You know, that's the whole thing, is once more, sentient beings don't know what they don't know. They don't know that things are falsely appearing to them. And they don't know that they're clinging to them as real in that way. So essentially, they are caught up in a whole web of deception that they are completely unaware of. But this is the process. Something appears and is labeled. That's the first step. The label seems to absorb into the object and project back at us as if it's real from its own side. And then we agree to that. We don't question it. That's how we keep creating ignorance. And of course, every time we create ignorance and buy into that ignorance, we create the causes for there to be an additional moment of ignorance in the future, as well as the imprint that gives rise to that false appearance. It's a vicious circle. We just keep creating the causes for our own suffering. And it's not just us, of course. It's all these beings that we're observing here in this third level of compassion. It's observing beings within the understanding that this is what they are caught up in, compounding their own suffering, through never questioning the reality of things, through completely buying into that false appearance. So when I said that things are merely imputed, this is, just want to review this really quickly because it is an important part of our understanding of emptiness. The three levels of dependent arising, because they're even mentioned in the meditation that I gave you from Jeffrey Hopkins. When we start talking about things that exist, particularly those things that are caused, such as the self. The self is a phenomenon that has its causes and conditions. The body is a phenomenon that has causes and conditions. Most of what we deal with in our world has causes and conditions. There are very few phenomena that don't. But so let's just talk about those, because they have all three levels of dependent arising. Dependent arising, the Buddha said, is the way to understand emptiness from the side of how things actually exist, so that then we clearly understand how they don't exist. And when we think about it, you know, when we talk about this error that we're making, how we're grasping at things, one way we could describe that is we're grasping at them as if they have independent existence, as if they are able to stand on their own. That's what we mean by inherently existent, truly existent, existing from their own side. It means that they're independently standing alone on their own. Well, if we come to understand that everything exists in dependence upon things, that they are dependent arisings, then they can't have independent existence. These two are contradictory. That's why it's one of the most powerful ways of developing our understanding of emptiness, because it never falls into what we call that extreme of nihilism that we talked about. Remember how we had that non-dual understanding that's free of the two extremes that we talked about as one of the causes, especially of these sharp faculty bodhisattvas that analyze emptiness before they generate great compassion and so on, or bodhicitta and so on. So essentially, when we begin to work with dependent arising, it's help us find that middle way between reifying things, thinking they exist inherently, and negating things as existing at all. So when we are able to put those ideas of dependent arising into play, we can see that dependent arising and emptiness are kind of two sides of the same coin. Dependent arising, speaking to how they actually exist. Emptiness, speaking to the point of how they lack any independent existence. And this is what I'm just going to talk about this briefly, because I think it's important as we're talking about emptiness to at least touch on that reasoning and to review it. Most of you, I'm sure, have had teachings on it before. So when we talk about something that is a produced phenomenon, and let's use our body, because it might be easier to talk about our body. And our body is so involved in, of course, in the basis of being the self, the I that we are imputing and what have you. But first of all, the body is dependent upon its causes and conditions. What are the most substantial causes for your body? The two cells that came together in your parent, in your mother's womb, the sperm cell from your father, the egg cell from your mother, when those united and became the basis for this body, that is the beginning point for those two cells that were other, that were from your two parents, that came together and began the process of those cells replicating, reproducing, and forming into, you know, the fetus and eventually coming out of the womb, and the continuity of that body that is still with you right now. Those were the substantial cause of that. But you had many other conditions that were cooperative in creating this body, because obviously all the nutrients and food that your mother ate allowed you, this body, to continue to grow and develop in her womb. And then, of course, everything that you've eaten that is fed into this body, the exercise you've given this body, all the various things that fed into this body's continuity and being there are absolutely part and parcel of why this body exists today. Is there a body that exists independent of those causes and conditions? Of course not, right? You know, this one's pretty easy to get, but we don't really get the very subtle understanding of that. That's already pointing to emptiness, because we think in our minds that there's some sort of independent body. Well, how could it be independent if it relies upon all those causes and conditions to come into existence? But that is a coarser one of the three, because, again, we'll see that it does get a little bit subtler, especially when we get to the third level of dependent arising. The second level of dependent arising is when we think about the parts of that particular phenomenon, in this case, the body, and how there is a whole, which is body, which is dependent upon those parts. Okay, so when we talk about the parts of the body, there are infinite parts, right? Because you go down to microscopic parts and subatomic parts and whatever, you know, all these various things that, you know, scientists do. Let's talk about kind of basic parts. We have the torso, we have the head, and we have the four limbs, okay? Of course, there's lots of other parts within each of those. Is there a body that exists independent of those parts? Now, you might have a body missing a limb or something like that. We're not denying that that's a possibility. We wouldn't say that somebody who's lost an arm or a leg, that they don't have a body any longer. But you have to have some parts of a body to be able to constitute the whole that we call a body. And maybe somebody doesn't have all of their body parts there because of, you know, missing a limb or what have you. But it doesn't mean they lack a body, but we still have a sense of body in relationship to some quantity of parts. Is there a body that exists independent of those parts? Is there a whole that exists independent of the parts for any phenomenon? No, because the whole and the parts are interdependent. You have the whole body with its various parts. Can you, again, have a body that is completely independent of those parts? No way. Third level, we start looking at those parts of the body as what we call a basis of designation. And we come to understand that the way that body exists in the subtlest level of dependent arising is as a mere designation, an imputation, a labeling of body on this collection of stuff. That there's no real body here at all, only the idea of body, the concept of body that we are putting on this collection of stuff. And here we come to the conclusion, can there be a body that exists independent of that conceptual mind designating it as body? We like to think that there is because, again, we believe in that false appearance. We think that there's some bodiness that exists in this collection of stuff that is the body and that we're just, you know, correctly identifying that through designating it as body. But we're the ones that designated it as body. We gave it its bodiness. It didn't have bodiness from its own side. Bodiness came from our own minds. This is the subtlest way that everything exists. When we talk about the I is merely a label that we're given to the, giving to this collection of body and mind. There is no real I here. I is only that and merely that, that mere label or designation that is the thought of I in relationship to this basis. And of course, the other analyses that we are useful to engage in are to go searching for that I, that real I that we think is there so profoundly and prominently. And you bring that sense of an I to mind and you go searching for it and you say, well, okay, the most likely place it's going to be is on this collection of stuff. Can I find something that is the real I? You can do it with the body as well. Can you find something that is the real body? Is the head the real body? Is the torso the real body? Is the are the arms the real body? Legs the real body? Where do you find the real body? Where do you find the real I? Is the I the real I the mind? Is the real I the body? Again, you go looking for these things and you find that there's nothing that is that sense of a unitary object that we have identified, such as an eye or a body, that is identical to that. Instead, there's only a bunch of stuff that we are labeling as that. This is that third level of dependent arising that can be validated by that type of investigation. Now, of course, in that investigation, you also don't just look on this collection of stuff for the eye. You also, you know, take into consideration, well, maybe the I is something else. But that's really easy to prove as a, you know, falsity. Because right now, I don't have the idea I'm sitting out in my living room, do I? You know, where is there an I out in the living room while the body and mind are here in front of the computer screen? You know, it just doesn't happen, right? So we know that if we take the mind and body and we set them aside, there's no I remaining there that we go, oh, there you are. You're completely independent of the body and the mind. You don't need to even be here, you know, because the body and the mind aren't involved. So we'll just put all the body and mind aside and the I is still remaining there, sort of stands on its own. So again, I've introduced sort of two forms of analysis. The dependent arising, which is examining these three levels with regard to the I, with regard to the body, with regard to any phenomenon. Can you find, again, it exists independence on its causes and conditions, upon its parts, and in the end, upon it merely being labeled by a conceptual mind, by designation, by imputation. And then, of course, that is proven out when we go investigating to see if there is some sort of real I on that basis or real body on that basis. Instead, we find nothing that is that sort of unitary phenomenon that appears to us so vividly and real. Nothing can be found that is equivalent to it, that is the exact referent of it, that has all the qualities that I has. I mean, for example, if you were to take the body and the mind as the basis for the I, well, then if you say, is the body equivalent to the I in all ways? Is that the real I? Well, then mind wouldn't be involved then, right? You know, it would only be a body. You wouldn't mind anything that has to do with mind has nothing to do with the eye, only the body. But if you say, well, it's both the body and the mind, well, then do you have two eyes? Do you have not two eyes like that? Two eyes, capital eyes? Do you have the eye that is the body and the eye that is the mind? I mean, do they get into conflict? You know, the eye that is the mind wants something that the eye that is the body doesn't want, and then they fight with each other. I mean, maybe sometimes it feels like that, but we don't really have two senses of eye here. there's a unitary eye that is labeled, designated on this collection. There's no real eye that you can find on this basis. This is what we mean by emptiness, lacking that independent, inherent existence, not having that in the slightest, not an atom of it. And yet we believe in the opposite. This is kind of to take it back then to this compassion we're talking about. This compassion is observing sentient beings, knowing that they lack inherent existence too. Every single one of them was without any inherent existence, and yet they believe in the opposite. They are adhering to the opposite, and they're getting into trouble on the basis of that misconception. That's the root of their problems. So our compassion becomes even greater because we understand that this is so unnecessary that these beings suffer because of this error. If they were able to correct that, what is seemingly a slight error, obviously it takes a lot of energy to overcome that mistake, but if they were able to correct that error, their suffering would be over. Their stay in samsara would come to an end. They'd be able to go on to attain enlightenment, become a Buddha, what have you. But they're blind to that reality. As I said a couple of times already tonight, they don't even know that they don't know that that's how they exist, that how all things exist is through mere imputation, that they all lack inherent existence. So this is, again, where our heart should really break when we unite our compassion with that level of understanding, where we're really getting how beings are buying into something that's not real. One example that I like to use, and then I will get back to the text because I do want to finish most of the text if we can tonight, is the example of a child. Say you have a child who's, for whatever reason, they saw a movie and there was a monster, and they got it in their head that there's a monster in their room. You know, maybe this has even happened with some of you that are parents, is that you had a child who believed in something that was not real. So they wouldn't sleep well, they wouldn't get to bed easily, they'd wake up in the middle of the night screaming and yelling, oh, the monster's in the room, the monster's in the room. It would break your heart because you know that they're believing in something that isn't real. All the pain, all the problems they're having, you know, the distress that's occurring for them is because they're believing in something that isn't existing in reality. And of course, if you were the compassionate, kind parent that I'm sure each of you are, you would go into that child's room at night and help them to see that there is no monster. You know, turn on all the lights in the closet, put a flashlight under the bed, go into every corner of the room, show them that, no, there's no monster here. You know, this is, feel, you know, sorry for them, try to comfort them in their distress, but try to show them that what they are believing in isn't real. And of course, over time, doing this every night, making sure that the child sees that there's no basis for that misconception of a monster, they eventually let go of that misconception and they go to bed peacefully. And then they, you know, don't have any of those problems left. Again, this is a mundane example, but I think it's really useful. Because once more, if we look at sentient beings through the same lens, they're all dealing with this monster that is their own ego they've created, their own sense of self that they've exaggerated, that what is there is so slight, they call it just nominal existence, mere imputation. They've layered on top of this all this, you know, misconception about a real self, and they've believed in that, and it has been the source of all their misery since beginningless time. What should break our hearts? You know, we should want to help them to be free of that. That's what great compassion is wanting to benefit others, to help them to be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And the deepest cause of suffering is this misconception of a self, this grasping at this real I that is their monster that they have believed in and are behaving from that standpoint, having all the problems of samsara on the basis of that. Okay, so I'm going to hear... let's go through this. I think I can go through this relatively fast. Many Tibetan commentators, this is page 15 still, say that the second compassion observes momentary disintegration and the third observes emptiness, non-inherent existence. These are explanations of those who have not understood well the subjective aspects and objects of observation of these two compassions. For it is necessary to assert that both have the aspect, as we saw earlier, of wishing to free sentient beings from suffering. And if momentariness and non-inherent existence were asserted as the objects of these aspects, in other words, if they were actually observed observing impermanence and emptiness, not sentient beings qualified in that way, then one compassion would have two discordant aspects as its mode of apprehension, because it would also have the realization, you know, the aspect of realizing momentariness or non-inherent existence. What this is essentially saying is you're not actually observing emptiness or impermanence at that time. You're observing sentient beings qualified by that. Because otherwise you would have two different objects you're observing. You're observing sentient beings all the time with great compassion. There is no great compassion that isn't observing sentient beings. It's just how are they qualified? And I think that qualification is understandable. I mean, just like with the first type of compassion, what are you doing there? Through that analogy of the bucket and the well, you're understanding sentient beings qualified in terms of how they are suffering. The processes by which they go from the top of the well to the bottom of the well, all the various states of existence, da, 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 all the things we looked at. Well, you bring that information in and your compassion deepens just by getting the extent to which sentient beings are suffering. As I mentioned in a previous class, you know, our compassion is oftentimes limited because we only see the grosser forms of suffering, right? If we think, you know, oh, this is a person who's really well off and they're living the high life and they're doing all these wonderful things and they don't seem to be suffering at all. Why should I have any compassion for them at all? Well, if we understand that they too are like that bucket in a well, they too are under the control of all these factors and they've gone through all the various iterations of the samsara and are continuing to experience all the various states, well, then we generate a greater compassion for them. So that first level of compassion is no different in that we are taking sentient beings as the observed object, whichever ones we're observing at that time, qualifying them by this full understanding of how they are suffering, which once more most beings are blind to. Again, they don't even know that they don't know. The second and the third are just taking those same sentient beings. We're not going to focus on their suffering aspect because hopefully we've got a good understanding of that through the first one. Here we're going to look at them as being qualified by that momentary change, that impermanence, that's subtle as well as gross, you know, through their death and what have you. And then the third one, their emptiness of inherent existence. But with the understanding that they're clinging to the opposite. They believe they are permanent, unchanging. There's something sort of essentially here that they are clinging to in that way that is belied by their impermanence. And then they are clinging to something as being real and substantial and inherently, independently there that is belied by emptiness. So this is the idea behind it. They're not observing those actual realities. They're observing, you are not observing those actual realities of impermanence and emptiness. You're observing sentient beings qualified in that way. So, sentient beings qualified by momentariness or impermanence and non-inherent existence are put as the objects of observation of these two compassions. Thus, before a person can have these two in their mental continuum, they must ascertain that sentient beings are momentary and do not inherently exist. Right? You have to have that understanding. Just like with the first one, you have to understand all of these various elements involved in the analogy of the 6 points of karma and delusions and all the various things involved in creating the conditions for sentient beings to suffer in order for you to have that knowledge. But here too, you have to understand impermanence and emptiness to be able to see sentient beings qualified in that way. So then it says, then, in dependence on their previous ascertainment, the aspects of these two qualities must appear to their mind. However, it is not necessary that these compassions themselves apprehend sentient beings as impermanent or not inherently existent. In other words, the appearance of these qualities to a compassionate mind due to previous ascertainment is sufficient. So as long as we have gotten some knowledge of that somewhere along the way, their impermanence, their emptiness, then we can bring it into that compassion that is observing those beings and thinking of them qualified in that way. So next paragraph I'm going to go through, and then I'm going to skip a little bit. In both the basic text, the root verses we're looking at, and the commentary, his auto-commentary, Chandrakirti explains that the latter two compassions observe sentient beings qualified by the qualities explained above, and says that mere sentient beings who are not so qualified are the objects of observation of the first compassion. Therefore, his giving the name compassion observing sentient beings to the first compassion is a convenient contraction as well. So again, we're just looking at sentient beings that are not qualified by their impermanence or emptiness, but certainly qualified by their suffering, really understanding their situation. So again, we're going to skip this next paragraph because it's going back to those coarser views of a self that are being refuted when we come to understand the impermanence of the person and what have you. So here, top of page 16, Tsongkhapa says, no matter which of the three objects of observation these three compassions observe, each has the aspect of wishing to protect all sentient beings from all suffering. Again, we've heard this before. I guess Tsongkhapa really wanted to make this clear. This is the aspect, the subjective aspect of these. We are looking at sentient beings, however we're qualifying them, and wanting to protect them from suffering, all suffering. Therefore, he says, they differ greatly from the compassion generated by hearers and solitary realizers. Again, we talked about those folks at the beginning of the class as well, this course as well as in the second class. Those are the practitioners of the fundamental vehicle, the Hinayana, and they essentially generate compassion. You know, without a doubt, they generate the four immeasurables, which most of you are quite familiar with. I did a course on the four immeasurables for Kadampa Center some years ago. But essentially, those are measurable thoughts that they do try to embrace all beings, but they don't go to the extent of wanting to protect beings from suffering. So when you have a measurable compassion in those traditions, you have a compassion for the suffering of all beings and not wanting them to suffer, thinking of, you know, may they not suffer. But you don't actually go to that Bodhisattva step, that Mahayana step that thinks, I will protect them from that. That is unique to the Mahayana, to the Bodhisattva path. So, continuing in that paragraph, Tsongkhapa says, when practitioners generate such compassions, they generate an altruistic mind of enlightenment on the basis of that, thinking, for the sake of sentient beings, I will definitely attain the state of a Buddha. Again, we saw this previously. They take that compassionate thought that thinks, I want to protect beings from suffering, and then they unite it with, that's the object of intent, free them from suffering. The object of attainment is that we have to attain Buddhahood in order to do that. Again, I'm not going to explain those again because I went through those previously in the last two classes. So the next paragraph, the compassion to which Chandrakirti offers worship is mainly initial compassion, but it is also the other compassions of bodhisattvas. Because remember, again, he's talking about what becomes the cause for that actual bodhisattva. Because again, this was part of the three causes, which were great compassion, the non-dual understanding I alluded to a short while ago, and the altruistic mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta, that we just saw in the previous paragraph. So the compassion he's worshiping is mainly this initial great compassion. But it also includes the compassions of the bodhisattvas once you become a bodhisattva that continues on the path. Again, because we saw once more, let me take it off screen, we had compassion being important at the three times. Remember that teaching? That wasn't that long ago. It's important at the beginning, like the seed. It's important in the middle, like the water. And it's important at the end in terms of the fruition in the state of Buddhahood. So again, we have paying homage to compassion, great compassion throughout all of these stages of the bodhisattva, not just in the initial phase. So that's obviously what's being highlighted here, is what becomes the cause for that novice bodhisattva, that initial moment of becoming a Mahayanist. Okay, so a question arises. Can all three types of compassion be a cause of bodhisattvas when they first enter the path? Sorry, I corrected that in the original after I saw this version of it. Path should be up on the previous line. I get kind of nitpicky when I see things like that, sorry. But the answer is, those bearing the Mahayana lineage who are followers of fact, this is what we mean by those who've developed sharper faculties. They're not following just words, they're not just kind of hearing the words and believing in them, they are actually doing the investigation, checking things up, coming to understand the facts. You know, they initially seek knowledge of the true suchness, emptiness. Once they have ascertained the ultimate well, they generate an altruistic mind of enlightenment, which is founded on generating great compassion for sentient beings, and then train in the discipline of a subduer, you know, the bodhisattva deeds, all the practices, six perfections, what have you. Those bearing the Mahayana lineage who are followers of faith cannot realize suchness first. So once more, if we go back to, I don't know, I may have taken it off here. Yeah, there it is. the chart. When we go back to this chart that shows here on the left-hand side, these three causes that we saw in the second verse, that are the three causes of a bodhisattva, I think it was the second verse, anyway, these three are actually, maybe the first verse, anyway, these three are not always present with every bodhisattva. Great compassion without a doubt. The training in the mind of enlightenment, that is like the tasting the bark that becomes the sugar cane when you develop it at the, you know, taste of the sugar cane when you become a full-fledged bodhisattva with that spontaneous, uncontrived bodhicitta. Those have to be there. Non-dual awareness, or this non-dual understanding of emptiness, that is there for those who are followers of fact, who are sharp faculty bodhisattvas that we can aspire to be, that we can, and we already are to some degree, by examining this topic of emptiness before generating bodhicitta. But normally it starts with great compassion because we see the suffering of the world and we want to alleviate it. Then we check up as a sharp faculty or, you know, follower of fact bodhisattva. We check up to see if it can be attained. And that's through understanding that emptiness can be realized, that it is factual, and that it can be the antidote to all the problems that we and others have. And then we go on to generate bodhicitta. That's what Tsongkhapa was saying in that last little part that I just read. Those who are followers of faith, who simply depend upon the words, who generate great faith in the Mahayana without doing that investigation, don't realize suchness first. But of course, they have to go on to realize it eventually. So they generate an altruistic mind of enlightenment, after which they train in the bodhisattva deeds, such as searching for knowledge of the meaning of reality. So Shantarakshita's Ornament of the Middle Way says the following. First, searching to know reality, they ascertain well the ultimate emptiness, and then generate compassion for the world obscured by bad views. Heroes, bodhisattvas, affecting migrators' welfare, skilled in the vast mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta, they practice the subduer's discipline, the deeds of the bodhisattva, the perfections, and so on, adorned with wisdom and compassion. Followers of pure faith generate the mind of perfect enlightenment, assume the discipline of the subduer, and strive then for knowledge of reality. So where that knowledge happens in that investigation into emptiness is contingent upon the bodhisattva. Some will do it before they enter the path when they're not even a bodhisattva. Some followers of faith will do it after they become a bodhisattva. So thus, there are two types of practitioners. And among them, there are cases of generating all three compassions prior to becoming a bodhisattva. The followers of fact realize emptiness before becoming a bodhisattva and thus can generate compassion observing sentient beings qualified by non-inherent existence. So when we talk about those three types of compassion, the initial question, can the, you know, all three of them be there before one enters the path? Absolutely. For those followers of fact, they will have a mind that is familiar enough with emptiness through their own investigation prior to generating bodhicitta that informs their great compassion in the way that we're talking about. And of course, they also will potentially have an understanding of impermanence. So, the final paragraph, even though one has previously found the view of suchness, so even if you're a follower of fact who has found emptiness to some degree prior to the path, it is not contradictory that when training in the actual bodhisattva deeds, which include the perfection of wisdom, right? That's the sixth perfection. One ascertains and trains in the meaning of suchness. And then he goes on to say, not only is that not contradictory, it's the way it must be done. So this kind of ends. There is more to the commentary that goes into kind of moving into the text from here. But that's what I wanted to share with you in terms of these verses. And it ends with that idea that, you know, having been informed in this way of these three levels of compassion, it doesn't mean that you've actually attained what the bodhisattva yet has to attain. You will then enter the Mahayana path with the full understanding of great compassion, the wisdom that understands how things exist, that feed into your bodhicitta, that then cause you to continue the development of those on the path, eventually achieving the perfection of wisdom on the sixth ground. Again, that was where it is brought to its greater surpassing level, but obviously you have to attain a direct realization of emptiness way prior to that to enter into the path of seeing. Again, just to clarify what I'm meaning by that, I'll once more pull up that chart that I've alluded to a few times already, one time tonight. The Bodhisattva who is entering the Mahayana path newly, who didn't complete the Hinayana path previously, has a conceptual understanding of emptiness throughout these first two paths, path of accumulation and path of preparation. The first initial direct realization of emptiness happens on the path of seeing when we have the path perfection of wisdom for the first time. That's when we also have what we call ultimate bodhicitta for the first time, the wisdom realizing emptiness directly that is together with the mind of bodhicitta that is conventional. That happens with the path of seeing. When we go into our second direct realization of emptiness, it's capable of beginning to remove more of the obstructions. We continue on through that process on the path of meditation, removing bit by bit all of the various levels of afflictive obstructions, knowledge obstructions, everything that keeps you from becoming a Buddha, and then you finally enter the path of no more learning. So what Tsongkhapa was saying there essentially is, you know, even though you've realized some of this prior to the path, you still have to go through all of the deeper work that actually gets you to those realizations. And that's, of course, where he takes off from here and goes to the rest of his text. And the text explains those 10 grounds and the various perfections that the Bodhisattva brings to culmination. But as I mentioned way back in the first class, the bulk of the text is the perfection of wisdom, the sixth chapter, because it's on that sixth ground that the perfection of wisdom is brought to the surpassing level. So this is where Chandrakirti goes into amazing explanations of different techniques for realizing emptiness, and really amazing chapter. I do hope you get a chance to study it in its entirety at some point. But as I mentioned previously, know that, again, Thupten Jinpa's translation of that has just come out earlier this year. So you can find that. It's called Illuminating the Intent, if you have a desire to study it. But know that it's really useful to have a commentary, even though that's a commentary on Chandrakirti's text. It's good to have a commentary from a living master on the commentary. It becomes like all these layers that really do help to dissect the meaning of these texts. Because it's not easy, as you saw. I'm sure there were passages in this that when I was reading them, you were going, what in the hell is that talking about? And then hopefully my talking about it, not that I'm any great commentator, but hopefully I allowed you to get a little bit more meaning out of those words. So let me open it up to questions. I do have a few kind of closing quotes that I want to share, but are there any questions? I didn't see anything in the chat box. Anyone have anything from tonight or from the entirety of what we've talked about these four sessions? Nothing? You're all fully realized Buddhas. Yes, Ginger.
You were talking about the eye, big eye and little eye, and that it's all imputed. Mm-hmm. But I got a little lost about not going all the way to nihilism or nihilism.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So what in the consciousness that we supposedly carry from lifetime to mm-hmm. lifetime, or reincarnation, whatever, yeah, life it is. And, so what happens to, where's the consciousness fit into that also? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay, good. Now, this is a good question, Ginger, because essentially when we talk about, this is again with this idea, when we delineate the middle way, this perfect medium between the extreme that we've been in, thinking things exist independently, intrinsically, and then we start getting these teachings and we start veering over into this other extreme, which is things don't exist at all. What can happen sometimes, again, is when we hear these things about no inherently existent I, you know, this capital I that we're adhering to, we start thinking, well, then that's negating that there's anything that exists sort of really that is the I. Well, we always have a basis for an I, because there's always a continuity of consciousness. Even in the tantric teachings, they say that there's also a subtle energy, a wind energy that goes together with the subtlemost mind of clear light. This sort of thread of awareness that goes through all of our existences, that's together with this subtle energy, this wind energy. This is a basis for a continuity of an I, but not a real I, a merely imputed I. Once more, because is that, I mean, because this is something you should do in your investigation. If you're looking at, well, all of these various parts that you can dissect, go to that level. Is this thread of the clear light mind, the subtlemost mind that goes from life to life, together with this wind energy, is that the real I? well, we do have some problems if we start thinking that that's the real I. First of all, we're not in that level of experience hardly at all. So we're at a much grosser level of awareness and identifying an I and what have you. And our I exists at that grosser level of awareness in a very valid, conventional way. So we would be negating anything else that is not that, if that is the real I. But it can be posited as a basis for I without any problem. Why? Because there is a continuity of a sense of I that always goes together with whatever manifestations are happening around that core of consciousness. So that core of consciousness is the thread that goes through all these existences. But it is not the real I any more than the grosser levels of awareness are the real I, or the body is the real I, or anything else is the real I. All those things act as a basis for whatever I we happen to be imputing at this time. Right now, I'm merely imputed Don, on the basis of the consciousness that is together with this human existence, which has its own unique properties that are different, obviously, from a cat consciousness. If I look at my cats, I can see that they definitely don't have the same awareness that a human being has. I'm not trying to put them down. It's different. They don't have the ability to sit in front of a screen like this, get teachings like this, and begin to digest them and work with them and meditate on them. So there's a human consciousness that is together with this human body that I have, that is has it at its core this clear light mind. But again, it's manifesting in a much grosser way. And I'm thinking of this mind and body, as Don. I'm merely imputing this as Don, or as me, I. I don't think of myself as Don, I think of myself as I. And that will have a continuity throughout all of Don's existence. When Don's consciousness, my consciousness, exits from this life, at the end of this life, goes on to another existence, it will then have a new mind. Let's hope it's a better mind than this one. But anyway, we'll have, a new embodiment, a new mind, a new sense. And there will be, of course, that core consciousness that's there. But it'll be a grosser level dependent upon the functioning of that. And if I happen to fall into a cat life, well, then I'm going to have a cat mind. And I'll have all the problems of being a cat, totally obsessed with, sleeping and eating and whatever. So the idea is, again, that although, yes, there is a continuity of awareness, is rebirth, there is karma, there are all these things, they don't exist inherently. They can't be found to exist inherently. And of course, anything that is involved in the basis for a person cannot be found to be the basis for an inherently existent person. An inherently existent person doesn't exist among them. There's nothing that can be found that is the person in all ways, because that would, again, belie the other ways that person can be known. If we reach that pure consciousness that is this thread of clear light mind, well, then I couldn't be Don, because Don is not that. You're not imputing Don to clear light mind. You're imputing Don to the grosser levels of awareness that are in front of you and the physical body that's in front of you. You see what I mean? So this is the danger we have when we start getting introduced to these teachings on emptiness, is that we can fall over into this nihilistic thing and think, there's no self at all. And it's even tricky, because some of the ways that these meditations on emptiness are put together, they say, well, go look for the I. Well, you're not really looking for the I. You always have to go back to, you're looking for the sense of a real I that you've been believing in. There is an I, but again, it's nominally existent, merely imputed, merely designated. Nothing more than that. Does that help some, Ginger? Okay. So this is something we're going to spend this life probably and many lifetimes working on. Be very patient with yourself in terms of finding that middle way. And know that, this isn't the only way we fall into nihilistic bends, because we have nihilistic philosophies in the West, right, that don't have any investigation into emptiness. They just think, it's just all utter non-existence, and, there is no God, there is no I, there is no nothing. You don't have to be a genius to think of those sorts of things. But the idea is that, when we talk about our middle way with regard to this Buddhist view, we see that what's over here is this clinging tightly to the I as being real in the way that we think it is. They say that to get a really good feel for how that I is manifesting, think about times when you've had very heightened emotions, such as fear, when you felt somewhat endangered, when you felt like someone was falsely accusing you. The I seems to jump up and want to defend itself. That's when it's more exaggerated, but we have it with us a good part of the time. That's what we want to avoid over here, is move away from by seeing it's not there at all, but don't get to the point where you negate everything, where you think it doesn't exist at all, because things still exist. Buddhahood exists. You exist. I exist. Yes, John, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you. You know, I did put a question in the chat box at the beginning.
Oh, you did.
It's not visible to you? Or?
No. I'm sorry. When I came in, see, one of the problems with chat on Zoom is that anything, when somebody enters after you've put something in the chat box, they don't get it.
Oh.
It's invisible to them. So I'm sorry. Do you have an ability to read that?
Yeah, I can see it. Maybe if you don't mind, I can.
Please. Yeah, because I don't see it at all.
It's something, you know, because I've been following the previous three classes on YouTube, and I wanted to join tonight.
Uh-huh.
But it's something that I've been thinking about pretty much since the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I think to a great extent, you actually answered much of this in tonight's class. It's, well, let me just read this and see if I'm...
Okay.
So given that directly realizing emptiness is the sole and essential cause to end bondage to samsara, mm-hmm. and that this realization entails a firm conviction of the realizer's intimate connection with all beings to the extent that bodhicitta is transformed from merely contrived to a spontaneous wish firmly rooted in the practitioner's experience, and that the great compassion directed toward all beings arising from this experience is a cause of bodhicitta, mm-hmm. isn't it more logical to understand the root cause of the three of great compassion, non-dual awareness, and bodhicitta as non-dual awareness? Mm-hmm. And bodhicitta, so that the root cause to me seems to be non-dual awareness followed by great compassion, and then, of course, bodhicitta. So, and I think, you know, much of what you said tonight made me wonder whether this teaching is in that class of figurative teachings as opposed to, you know, teachings on emptiness, which are more literal.
Yeah. I mean, there's some truth to what you're saying, John. At the same time, it reminded me of something I read in this In Praise of Great Compassion that I cited from earlier. Again, this volume 5 of it's called The Library of Wisdom and Compassion that His Holiness and Venerable Chodron are putting together. It's on page 198. Let me read it, and then we'll talk about it a little bit. He says, "Nevertheless, an understanding of emptiness deepens our compassion and vice versa." Maybe this isn't the passage. There was another passage earlier. Oh, here it is. It's earlier in that page. Okay, it says, okay, while the third compassion, the compassion that's observing the unapprehendable, seeing sentient beings qualified as lacking inherent existence, depends on a deep understanding of emptiness, in general, compassion and emptiness are cultivated separately. The former, compassion, involves transforming the mind into the entity of compassion. The latter entails realizing an object not previously known, emptiness, the nature of reality. These require different types of meditation. Again, because one is forming the mind into the quality of compassion, the other is generating the understanding, the knowledge of emptiness, which is something we hadn't previously apprehended. Compassion will not automatically arise in our minds from realizing there is no inherently existent self to be attached to. We must also contemplate sentient beings suffering, their dukkha, as well as their kindness, and see them as endearing by following one of the methods to generate bodhicitta. So when he talks about it, I mean, how I was interpreting what I just read in the light of your question was that it's not a guarantee that if you realize emptiness that you're going to get compassion for all beings.
Yeah, that's, I've thought about that, but it just seems to me that if you have a depth of experience where you realize emptiness, the emptiness of inherent existence, that it seems to me that that would entail the experience of your very intimate connection with all beings, because as opposed to being contrived, it seems to me that that experience would entail direct knowledge of how every sentient being has in fact been in the most intimate of connections with you, in most intimate of relationships. So,
I mean, I do hear what you're saying.
That's how we move from the mm-hmm. contrived to the uncontrived, you know? Mm-hmm. That's when it becomes really deep.
But again, I do think that we can have both of them at some level that are independent of each other and not necessarily cause the other to arise. Because if we look at particularly with regard to those who are on the Hinayana path, the fundamental vehicle, they get to the same direct realization of emptiness that a bodhisattva does. In fact, they say there's no difference in terms of the nature of that mind that is directly realizing emptiness on their path of seeing compared to the bodhisattva's path of seeing and what is realizing being realized at that point. There's a difference in terms of bodhicitta being the underlying non-manifest mind that is involved in the bodhisattva, whereas for the Hinayanas, there's none of that present. But they are realizing the same thing. And when the Hinayanas comes out of that meditation, they don't immediately feel what you're talking about of this sort of vast interconnection to all beings and a desire then to benefit all of them on the basis of that. If they did, they would immediately enter into the Mahayana, realizing that that is part and parcel of their spiritual goal, that they don't want to just achieve their own liberation. They actually want to cultivate bodhicitta on the basis of great compassion and become a Buddha for their sake. But they don't do that. You know, at least in historically, this is what has been shown in terms of the three Buddhist vehicles of the hearer, the solitary realizer, and the bodhisattva. Mm-hmm. So again, you can have independent realizations of each of these that don't lead you necessarily to the goal of Buddhahood. But putting great compassion as the root was the idea, again, that with great compassion, either for the follower of faith, they go on to generate bodhicitta, and then they eventually have to combine it with a wisdom realizing emptiness further on the path to get there. Whereas for the follower of fact, the sharp faculty of bodhisattva, they still have to also start with great compassion that is concerned about the welfare of beings. Then they investigate whether it's possible to attain enlightenment on the basis of this topic of emptiness, and then they generate bodhicitta. So they will still, again, have to realize emptiness more directly, but they have generated already that conceptual understanding. So this is the rationale for compassion being the root of all of this as opposed to emptiness. But I've had the same concerns. I think you may have even heard in the earlier teaching where I also had this question about what is it like for those hearers or solitary realizers that come out of that realization of emptiness? And wouldn't there be some sense of that, again, that interconnection, that lack of the independent solid self that they then are feeling has been removed to some degree and wanting to embrace the welfare of others? But if they don't have a predisposition that is a sort of Mahayana lineage that is imbued in great compassion, then they don't have the means to take that to that path and to that fruition.
Yeah. I see that distinction. And I guess as well, it's a matter of them basically reinforcing each other as one progresses along the path, right?
So then definitely,
compassion strengthens the wisdom, gives the signal, you know, to have the realizations and so on.
You're welcome. Thanks for that question. This is what His Holiness goes on, and actually, this might be a good place. Were there any other questions from tonight? So let me go ahead and read this little paragraph, and I'm not going to go to my slides then because this was part of this was in my slides. It says, nevertheless, this is kind of continuing on this whole, nevertheless, an understanding of emptiness deepens our compassion and vice versa. For example, when I sit down to teach, His Holiness says, I notice that everyone in the audience appears to me to exist from their own side, not through the power of thought, not through mere imputation. They appear to be out there, each person on their own seat. I remind myself that this is a false appearance, that none of them are either inherently one with or separate from their body-mind. Looking out at everyone, I see that each person is thinking, I, as if they had their own inherent existence, and that is who they really are. This mistaken view brings forth their afflictions, which create polluted karma that leads them to experience difficulties in this life and in future rebirths and samsara. Seeing that, I cultivate compassion. So when he's observing beings in the audience, His Holiness says, this is if you, you know, had that good fortune of being in the audience with His Holiness, this is what he's doing. He's kind of understanding every one of those beings is having this thought of I that is elevated, reified to that degree, around which they are creating their delusions, their karma that are keeping them bound in samsara. And on the basis of that, he generates compassion. And then the last little bit in this section, which again, I would really encourage you to read in this book on what we just talked about, the three types of compassion. He says, Chandrakirti's homage to great compassion is most precious and profound. I hope you feel joyful in learning about it and will keep it in your heart as an invaluable treasure. And that's what I also hope. He kind of took the words away from me in a sense and said them so much more eloquently than I could. So I do hope that this study over these last three sessions and tonight has given you some understanding of this approach to compassion and the amazing power of great compassion in our path, and that you can use these teachings, again, as His Holiness says, a very precious and profound kind of support for your development of bodhicitta, the wisdom realizing emptiness, all the realizations of the path that are grounded in this great compassion. So thank you all so much for being here for this course. I've really enjoyed going through this with you so much. So,
thank you so much, Don. And we'd like to offer you a mandala.
Okay.
Sashi Puki Chukshin Metok Tramri Ravling Shi Nite Gen Padi Sangye Jindu Mikte Uwa Yi Jesun Lame Kuche Rakten Ching Nam Katrin Le Chok Chur Ge Padang Lo Zang Tan Pe Drun Me Idro Wemun Talk to Negurchik Idam Guru Ratnamandala Kam Nirya Chayami.
Thank you so much, Donna, for reciting that, and Linda for making the mandala offering. I'm really always touched by working with Kadampa Center. You are such a wonderful group, and I've really appreciated this opportunity. Before we do the dedication prayers, I really do want to acknowledge my precious root guru, Geshe Jampa Gyatso in Italy, who passed away in 2007, but was my teacher throughout the entire 7 years in the master's program. So anything I was able to share with you is due to his immense kindness. So I need to sort of give credit where credit is due and make sure that, you know, I acknowledge the role that he's played, as well as all my other teachers, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Lama Zopa, and so on. Let's go ahead and do some dedication prayers. Make sure that none of this merit, not a drop of it, is wasted in any way, and all brings forth the result of perfect enlightenment for ourselves and others. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Then we do prayers for these precious teachers that we are so dependent upon. We can think about these three teachers we're going to bring to mind, but all other spiritual guides as well, in whatever traditions they're in. May they have good health and long lives so that we and others can continue to benefit from their guiding presence. And may we and all beings always have perfect spiritual guides in our lives. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And then for Lama Yeshe's reincarnation, Tenzin Nelsohita, Venerable One, to you whose kindness exceeds that of all the conquerors for those wanderers in far-off places, especially the West, mindful of your loving concern for us and intentionally descending again into a family of a far distant land, we make this request. O Lama, please, please live long. And especially make strong prayers for the good health and long lives of your two precious gurus, Geshe Gelug and Geshe Tsongpo. Then let's just dedicate finally for all those beings that we're holding in our hearts right now, whoever we know or who we've heard of, whose situation moves us, thinking of their suffering, send this positive energy out to them so that they can be free from it immediately. Also that they can find all the causes and conditions that will help them to find true peace and happiness. And may all beings attain complete peace and happiness through what we've done here through this course and especially tonight. Okay, once more, thank you all so much. You're such an incredible group. You're so organized and do everything so nicely. Should all feel some good rejoicing in all of your good fortune to be involved with such an auspicious center. And I really look forward to seeing you all again in person. I don't know if I'll see you before Light of the Path. Let's hope Light of the Path happens next year. It's always such a wonderful gathering. I know many of you from that. So I do look forward to seeing you all at some point. But please stay safe and healthy, and I'll see you again soon. Be well.
Thank you so much, Don.
Thank you, Don.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Donna, too.
Yes, and a shout out to Donna for all of her amazing support and everyone involved in Kadampa that keeps, you know, everything going there. But Donna's pretty amazing, I have to say.
Mm-hmm. Thanks to my wonderful visiting teachers team who provides a lot of support.
Yeah, good, good. That's how to get things done, is to do it all together. And that way, one person doesn't have to bear the brunt of all of it. So, good. Thank you all so much. Be well
now.
All right, good night.
Bye-bye.